Hi, this is Josh from Hello PhD, and this is the full interview with Dr. John Shoup that Daniel did for episode 12, our Veterans in Science episode. Hope you enjoy.
Sure. John Shoup, professor of chemistry, Tiffin University.
Very good. Well, I know that you got the chance to read the question I sent over from Jake, and
I did.
I'm guessing this is not the first time you've come across a student in his situation. So can you talk a little bit about what you observed when you were working with veterans that returned from the service and enrolled in college?
Absolutely. And you got my answers, all right, because I sent back the answers.
I sure did. And I'm going to forward those on directly to him. But what I would like is for the listening audience to kind of understand what's happening, because I don't think it's on everybody's radar.
Well, here's what, let me just first of all tell you the birth of the program and how I came about it. It's important for vets to know why I did this, and because it's all about trust with a veteran, and they have to know what's the motivation behind a person doing something. So it all started in the fall of 06 when I had a student call me up with a chemistry question, because I always give out my number to my students. I say, you can call me till 1 a.m. with a chemistry question. I won't give them bail money, but I'll answer their chemistry question. So I had a student call me up fall of 06. With a chemistry question, and she went into that, and then she went into how she's going to make it for the first time in 10 years, and she's not going to fail or drop. And I said, that's great. I'm excited for you. What happened before? And when she said, when I came back from Kosovo, I just couldn't fit in, and I couldn't adjust, and I kept failing and dropping. I said to myself, well, is this normal, or is she an anomaly? Because I don't know anything about it at this point. I don't know anything about anything when it comes to vets and education at this point. So I did some research on it, and I realized, and by the time fall of 08 was around, that veterans don't succeed on campus. And I thought, well, why is that? Because, they've got the money for it, and the biggest anxiety for most civilians is the money. So I said, well, I got to find out why. And I didn't want to ask the present generation of vets because they weren't really back yet. And so I said, well, let me ask the Vietnam vets. They've been through it enough to know what it took and what their challenges were and so on. So, as a layperson, I mean, where do you find vets? Go to the VA. Okay. So I go to the VA in Cleveland. And I showed up and I said, I want to talk to some vets about, some Vietnam vets about education and so on. And they're like, okay, sure, have a seat. So I had a seat, people walk by, two or three hours goes by, they close at 5. Okay, you got to go. So I said, all right, fine. So I go, I want to come back next week, Tuesday, with donuts. Sat there from 2 to 5, they ate the donuts, and then that was it, and I had nothing. So this went on for about 3 or 4 weeks. And finally, after the fourth week, they finally said, what the heck do you want? And I said, all I want to do is talk to some Vietnam vets about their challenges. Now, what I didn't know at the time was, you just can't show up as a civilian because you got to develop trust. You got to work your way into it. And part of that was me coming up every week, and waiting. So finally, they said, okay, let's go. So I went into, I had a conference room set up with about 15 vets in a big square table. And Richard, when I asked a question about what were the challenges when they came back, Richard in the corner said, John, we weren't stupid. We just couldn't concentrate. And if you can't concentrate, you don't pass the exams, you fail, you drop out, you get so mad, you quit. So I said, okay, in my mind, I'm thinking, all right, there's two reasons for that. One is based upon the person themselves, which I can't change because I'm not a psychologist. And the other one is the environment, which I can. So I said, let me change the environment. So what I did was I took all civilians out of the classroom as an experiment and put all vets in, English 101, Math 101, and so on. So that was my experiment. Now, I had to convince the university to do this because, they didn't feel like doing it. So I had to show them how much money could be made if we do this. So it took me all of 06, about the last half of 06 and early 07 to convince the university to do it. And then by July of 07, I started recruiting. That was a disaster in the beginning on how to recruit. Oh, my God, it was terrible. So I learned the mistakes of how to recruit veterans. And it's all about one-on-one. It's not about big group meetings. It's not about a big job fair. It's none of that kind of stuff. It's all one-on-one because when they enrolled or enlisted in the military, it was one-on-one. They had a recruiter with them the whole way, developing a trust with them, and then they committed themselves for 4 years based upon that trust.
And so you're basically able to model that in the college recruiting.
Exactly.
Sector. Makes sense.
Exactly. Which they don't do in colleges. They just figure, let's do a blanket fair and hope we get 5%,
Yeah, it probably shows my ignorance because I would have said the same thing. I would have thought, these people are accustomed to being in large groups and being dealt with kind of at a non-individual level. And, you know, it would just make sense to me to do a recruiting fair.
And that's how they are when they're in. But they're in with a group of people who've developed trust with them. You know, before they commit themselves, it had to be one-on-one. You know, there had to be a relationship established between the recruiter and that branch of service and that potential, military person. So you don't see all that. All you see is them in groups. They're in companies. They're on patrols. They're, you know, so you see, well, they're used to being in large groups, but you don't see how they got to that point. Right. And that's what I had to learn. That was all the failures that I had. So finally, you know, I got my team students for fall of 08, and I had to learn how the whole campus worked from, you know, I was just a little part-time teacher. So I had to learn how the Treasury Department worked, registrars, the classes, how to create the classrooms themselves, where to put them, who's going to teach, you know, the tuition, all this kind of stuff. So I learned everything about the campus individually. And I didn't have committees. I didn't have meetings. I just went to people individually with donuts and, you know, and said, here's what I got to do. And when you do that and people realize you're doing it, then they go out of their way to help.
Mm-hmm.
So Cleveland State was great with that in the beginning. So then I had my first class. And we had English, math, I taught chemistry, and biology. And the challenge was trying to get teachers to teach it because they're all scared. You know, oh, my God, vets in the classroom all together, just vets. You know, like, don't worry about it. You're not going to teach this. I'm fine. Somebody else. So I finally got my four teachers. And I gave out the first exam because I wanted to see what would happen. So I had chemistry. So I handed my first exam out, and I was waiting, and they took it, and they handed it in, and there was no problems. No one tore it up. No one yelled and screamed. No one ran out. No, nothing. So I'm like, okay. So then I graded it. And I had a higher average than my siblings. And
is
I said,
right?
Okay, why is that? So I went back to Richard at the VA and I said, could the problem have been that your ability to not concentrate was that when you're stuck in a room full of civilians, you have been trained to evaluate the environment. The environment can kill you. The environment can cause harm. You have to protect the environment. This assignment can't do anything to me. So my focus is all around me and not on what's in front of me. Now, when you take away that pressure and you take away that the distractions from the civilians and put all vets in the classroom, now you don't have to worry about them because they're all on your side. They can protect themselves. You're not there protecting them. Now the assignment becomes more important. He said that's exactly what it was. They didn't know. So now I said, okay, fine. Now that I found the reason for this, if we have a whole semester of vets-only classes, and then the second semester, and these are all volunteer, they don't have to take all vet classes if they want to. Then the second semester, then I have 9 credit hours in veteran classes and 3 in civilian classes. This way they have a slower transition into the civilian world. And so I got, you know, full-time benefits is 12 credit hours. So then that will be a slower assimilation into the civilian world rather than just the first day you're on campus once you put the students. So then my GPAs went through the roof. I mean, they're a whole letter grade ahead of the civilian counterparts. And when I compared vets-only classes GPA to those vets who did not have the vet-only class GPA in the second semester in civilian classes, they were a half letter grade higher, those vets who had vet-only classes to begin with.
That's fantastic.
And then I began to explore which classes they should take. Because there's certain classes, I mean, when you go to an advisor, the advisor says, oh, you got to take math and English right away. Get them out of the way. Just get them out of the way, blah, 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 blah. That's the worst classes to have for vets. I learned that after the first semester. So what I found worked, classes-wise, was you give them, and I tell this to advisors all across the country, offer them psychology, sociology, and communications. That's what they're good at. They're good at communications. They know the psychology of the enemy, and sociology about working in groups. Give them those classes the first semester. They ace those. Then you give them math and English the second semester. So if they fail a math and English class, they won't go on probation right away. So just push it off one semester. That's what's working now. So now when advisors know this, then they suggest it to them, and then the veterans take hold of it, and they run with it. Now if I say if you need a foreign language requirement, then offer them sign language. Because that's what they do. And they ace the sign language.
So you set them up for an early win, and you get them in the right mental state. You put them around people that are supporting them, and they start with success rather than starting with failure.
Exactly. And it's a 15-week transition versus a one-day transition. So yeah. That's how I started it. And when I would speak to different schools in around the country or conferences, I was weird. I felt weird because, you know, when I hear someone else talk about it, their what they would do and what their programs were, they always specified, like, we had one vet who did this and we had one vet who did that. And I'm like, well, what about the other ones? And then I realized, because I felt out of place. I really did. My whole approach was different than most people speaking. So I'm thinking, well, why is this so different? Why am I the one who's the oddball? And then I realized, Daniel, I was the only chemistry person in this world of education.
Yep.
Everyone else is a psychologist and sociologist. So they look at the softer part of things. They don't do the scientific method like I do.
Yeah.
I mean, my scientific method was, here's the objective, okay? I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to collect data, put forth some results, and have a conclusion.
I mean, that's what's so fun about hearing you describe it. You did experiments. You said our first experiment was take the civilians out of the classroom. You were taking the scientific approach to this, what would traditionally be a social science problem. Yeah.
Versus a sociological approach, saying, well, what's wrong with these people? What's wrong with the vets? What's wrong? Why don't they fit in? No. You can do all that, but let me see if I can do this experiment and see what happens. Then I observed from that. And what I found was veterans are used to discipline, and they don't have discipline in the classroom. And the veterans are used to the person speaking as their superior, a full-bird colonel, a general, whatever, laying out the groundwork for that mission. That's what they're used to. Now, if you have a person up there speaking and kids are around you, Facebooking, texting, and everything else, then that veteran thinks he's not, what he's saying must not be important because they're not listening to him. So then the vet goes to the teacher and says, you know, what do I need to know what you spoke about today? Because he's trying to figure out what's important. And the teacher says, well, everything. And the vet's like, well, in his mind, it can't be everything because no one gave a crap. You know, he's used to being in a room where there's no talking, you're 100% attention, because that person, that general, that colonel, is laying out a battle plan, and if you don't adhere to it and listen to it, you may cost lives.
Yeah, it's not just a bad grade or you'll have to study harder on a weekend.
Exactly.
This is people in line.
So they're used to that environment. In the classroom, you have people in a room and you have a person speaking, but it's a whole different, you know, set of circumstances, and they don't get that right away. So when they ask for clarification, teacher has no idea why they're asking for clarification. They're just thinking, well, just trying to be lazy. No. I thought everything you said was important, but people around me didn't.
Yep.
So maybe I'm wrong, you know? And so I try to tell teachers, if you want them to understand this, you must have discipline in your classroom. Or if a vet asks you afterwards what's important, that's why he's asking you, not to question you. Because the environment they're used to this has 100% discipline and everything's important.
They're applying a certain set of mental filters to the information coming in, and it
exactly.
just doesn't happen to match the filters that are coming out of the professor's mouth.
Exactly. And so what I try to do is educate the university and the professors how that's important. And I try to tell the advisors. The advisors are the second most important person on the college campus. The certified official is the most important person. She or he is the most important person. They're the paperwork. That's all the official stuff has to get done. That's critical to their enrollment. The second most important person is the advisor, because the advisor lays out their mission for 4 years or 2 years. It lays out all the classes for them to take. So that veteran looks at the advisor as their superior officer. And what happens is advisors are the lowest paid people on the college campus. So they may not care that much, and they may leave and find another full-time position somewhere else. And if they get the wrong information about their mission, then the vet gets so fed up, now they can't trust leadership, they can't trust their superior, then they want to drop out. So I just had a webinar on advisors. I said, this is why what you say is important. And you when you talk to that veteran and you're getting his classes, schedule his classes to 3 days a week, or her classes, or 2 days a week. This allows days out of the week for them to go to a VA appointment. Because it's not a doctor's appointment, you can get changed. A VA appointment is made months and months in advance. And if you can't make it because you have an exam, you're put at the bottom of the pile again. So I said, schedule their classes 3 days a week or 2 days a week, so they have those days open to schedule their VA appointments, and they won't cause any problems with their course schedule. And these are the things that advisors have to know, because they're used to having full-time students who don't have these kind of critical appointments. So when I tell them that, I said, this is why what you're doing is important. This is why they look to you this way. Now, everything you tell them, they look upon so much differently than an 18-year-old student. And that's critical. And the last thing I try to tell the registrars, this was a huge obstacle for me to overcome, because their high school GPAs weren't good enough to get into universities in most cases. Because their high school GPAs, they didn't care about high schools when they were a senior or junior. They knew what they were going to do. They're going to the Marines. They're going to the Army, whatever. I don't need this class anymore. I don't care about this. Just give me a high enough GPA that I can graduate and get to my military. That's my career. So they don't do very well usually in their last 2 years or 1 year of high school. So now we look at the high school GPA, doesn't qualify them to get into that university. And I had that problem. So what I told my registrars was, give me them on a probationary status because they're not the same person they were in high school. If I had a person who sat on his butt for 4 years, who had a 2.2 GPA out of high school, sat on his butt for 4 years, and then wanted to go to college, no. They didn't do anything different. But if you have someone who got forced into discipline and time management and working together and success, and they have 4 years of that, they're not the same person they were in high school. Give them a chance. So she did, thank God, that and donuts. So she did, and I ended up having, and I compared my high school GPAs of these vets to their first year GPAs, they were a whole letter grade or more higher.
Yeah, because it's not a predictive indicator.
Exactly. They're a different person now. They have a whole set of disciplines that they never had before when they were 16 and 17. So we can't gauge them on that. And once I convince the universities of that, then they try to give in. I said, okay, fine, we'll give them a chance. We'll allow them in on probationary status or we'll do whatever. I said, fine, do that, and you'll see them succeed. So these are the things that I had to try to overcome from the university standpoint, that they looked at civilians at the same way as veterans and would reject them outright because of that. Yeah. Or they had problems or whatever, you know. And the other thing I found, too, and here's the history of this. When I looked at the history of the GI Bill and the success of veterans on campus, I looked at the World War II guys. My dad's World War II vet. And I looked at their success rate. And they had a 78% graduation rate. World War II vets. That's crazy. That's nuts.
Amazing. Yeah, I think the civilian rate now is around 50 or 60%, right?
For public universities, four-year grad rate is 30%.
Oh, is that right? Is that low?
Yeah, that's low. I'll give you the data on that. So, and there's reasons for that, okay? But I'm looking at these World War II guys, I'm going, what the crap? How did that happen? And then I look at the demographics of this group, okay? Three-fourths of these World War II vets did not have a high school diploma, okay? Half of them, when they enrolled in the university, were married, and half of them had children. So you had distractions and no education, and they graduated at 78%. What the heck? What caused that? That is such an unusual...
Sounds like an observation in need of a hypothesis.
And here's what I found. When I got numbers on this as far as the enrollment numbers. They succeeded because when they came back to campus, because before World War II and the GI Bill, you could afford to go to college. You had an elite group of people who went to college. Remember, this is during the Depression and before, okay? You couldn't afford college. It's the Depression. So all of a sudden, the colleges, who didn't want the GI Bill, by the way, and they lobbied hard against it, and I have people's quotes on that, now you have all these people coming into the college ranks that had never had high school education and are now in the colleges. So what happened was the colleges were swarmed with veterans. So the all-veteran class that I created was duplicated every day on college campuses. Every day. They worked together, supported each other, and got through it together. Just one more mission. Not a big deal. We can do this. That's why they succeeded at such a high rate. Because what I saw in my little, you know, English 101 class happened every day for 4 years during their tenure going through colleges. And then slowly more and more civilians came to college, you know, as the decades progressed and so on. So their percentage became less and less and less. But that first wave of GI Bill vets just took over the campus.
Yeah, they came in as a cohort.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, what I found, I did a study on suicides over the past 150 years of veterans. And I found that there's trends up and down and up and down. The Civil War, the suicide rate was about 30 per 100,000, okay? Many different variables involved in that. World War One was nearly 100 per 100,000. It was a terrible war. And we treated them like crap when they got back. And I've got all the data to support that. World War Two was 8 per 100,000.
Mm-hmm. The Greatest Generation.
Exactly. Korea was 17.
I mean, it's in the language that we use about them, how we viewed that war and how we viewed their victory.
But I'm looking at also at the same time. We didn't know that at the time. Remember, it's just a veteran coming back. So I'm looking at 5 years after the war ends, suicide rates, okay? So that's the data point I'm looking at. So at the time, they didn't know the Greatest Generation. They just came back from a war. So then I looked at Korea and then Vietnam. Vietnam was 32. Today, we're 46. We're the second highest since World War I in terms of suicides.
Wow.
So I looked at all the variables that were involved in, you know, I looked at economic variables. I looked at what the country was, how we accepted them, what we gave them, you know, what their fighting conditions were like, what was their tenure. World War I, Daniel, the average length of service for World War I was 6 months. It was the shortest of all the wars. And it was the highest of suicide rate. World War II was 4 years. Everybody spent 4 years in the military during World War II. So, and they had the lowest suicide rate. So I'm like, this doesn't compute.
Yeah, what is the connection?
Here's what happened. And I asked this of World War II vets. When they came back to college, because they owned it, because they were the classroom, they can discuss what happened in North Africa, what happened in Europe. They can talk about it on a daily basis before class starts and then class starts, okay? And they have English, then they have math, and they have whatever. And they do that, repeat it every day. So they had 10 minutes, essentially, of group therapy, and then class starts. And it's easier to discuss your past when you're immediately distracted by your present, meaning they discuss their past, and then they have English. They discuss their past, and they have math. So when they went home that day, they didn't have therapy. They had English. They had math. They had whatever. But if they spent an hour in therapy, they'd hate it. Talk about it. I can't deal with this. I don't want to talk about what happened. I lost my buddies. I don't care about it. Blah, 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 blah. Because there's no distraction. They're not working on their future. Okay? So that's what happened. But no one discussed it. No one logged it. No one studied it. Because when you're not committing suicide, who's going to study it? You know?
Yeah, and so that presumably that is not happening now. Now they're coming back. They're isolated. They're kind of cut off from the culture.
Exactly.
And they've got no support.
And they see the countries that they were in defending now falling apart to ISIS. So now we're having spikes in the suicides. So all these things I've studied and variables. So I said, if we get them to college campuses together as a group, as a cohort, they can discuss the past. Because they did that when I was in my English class, in my chemistry class. I get there. They're all early. Okay, that's 50 minutes early is on time. So they get there early, and I hear them discuss certain things. The anniversary of their buddies getting blown up, the anniversary of their enlistment, the anniversary of taking over Fallujah. You know, they would discuss those things, and I get in there, and then we start chemistry. Now they wanted to come to school because they can talk about stuff that no one else would talk about. And that's where the disabled vets had the best acceptance, as I mentioned in my email. What I found was my disabled vets wanted to come to those classes because all the healthy vets helped them succeed. All of them were there, and I had some guys that were pretty well blown up, but they went to that class because everyone there supported them, because they knew, as I said in my email, those healthy vets knew of someone in their unit that got blown up. I don't know what happened to them, so I'm going to make sure this person succeeds, because I don't know what happened to my guy. So everybody has that same kind of
instead
story.
Of being an oddity, or instead of being a kind of a source of stares or comments behind the hand, it's they know how that disabled vet became disabled, and that it was somebody they knew. It was their mate in the Army or in the Marines.
Exactly. I mean, they were the hero in those classrooms versus looked down upon. Like, well, why'd you even go in the first place? You know, why'd you go on that mission? Why'd you do that? Didn't you think about me, the family, you know? Didn't you think about us? Yep. Didn't you care about us? No, you in the classroom, and those guys know. Hey, listen, man, we're going to make this happen. You're going to succeed. I mean, it was a phenomenal sight that I didn't plan on seeing. These are the things when you observe them in a classroom and then you look at civilians, you see the differences and you compare the notes. This is all about the observations of the experiment. You know, these are all the things that I saw come out, you know, and that's why I realized that this is what the program, why it's succeeding, is because of these other little intangibles that I never thought about. Remember, my first objective was, or proposal was, reduce the environment's distractions and let them focus on the assignment. Mm-hmm. Well, that was true, but all these other things were part of it. And all the other things that I observed were part of why they wanted to do it and succeed. And I realized that this same thing occurred during World War II when they came back in the first GI Bill. So, and then that's, you know, why I kept it going. And then also I realized in 2009, I said, their vets are coming home to the country. They're not just coming home to Cleveland. They're coming home to the country. I've got to make sure I can tell other universities how to do this. Because if the more I empower those campuses, the better off the vets coming home to those campuses are going to succeed. And that's what I've made sure I've done. And that's why I've spoken to over 400 campuses nationwide. I've given business plans to over 200 of them to show how to make this happen, the financial impact of it and the human impact of it, so they know. You know, in their region, how many are coming home? How many are leaving in 2016 during the drawdown? What's the financial impact of those vets on that campus tuition-wise? And what's the financial impact of those vets on the community with the BAH? And what's the human impact in terms of suicides prevented, homelessness prevented, and divorces and children affected from those vets when they were coming back? I did all that. So a business plan, I can send you one. I just did one for Cabrillo College in California. So they understand when they go to their higher ed administrators, they can get a business plan that they can say, if we invest $100,000 and we get $100,000 from the community, the return on investment is this. And here's how many people we can impact based upon our enrollment. So that's the part of, you know, I did that for nothing. But that's part of me sharing what I had to learn and what I went through with as many people as I can, because I'm not going to repeat the wheel. I mean, I had so many failures in the beginning.
I mean, you have obviously invested an incredible amount of time and passion and energy into this. And you started the story by talking about the one student who came to you and said, you know, she was struggling with her classes. But two kind of related questions. Why is the academic success of veterans so important to you? And why should it be important to me and to other people at the university? I mean, you mentioned to the university, there's the kind of financial impact, but you're not, it doesn't sound like you're doing this purely out of financial impact.
Well, here's the thing. Once I did a study on the suicides, and I began to look at the history of this country, I realized that every time we embrace an era of veterans, we grow as a country. And every time we don't embrace an era of veterans, we fail as a country, or we flounder. So I thought, I looked at the GDP, I looked at, you know, all these different variables, and I said, well, why is that? Because I see the trend. You know, Civil War, we embraced the Civil War vets, I mean, like crazy. It was, the Civil War vets were so well taken care of, it was nuts. One-fourth of the budget in 1910 went to Civil War pensions. I mean, it was crazy.
Wow.
If you were a Civil War vet, it was law that you got considered for a position, in a government position, over a Spanish-American War vet. And the Spanish-American War was 1900. So the latest vets didn't get that. You took precedence over a Spanish-American War vet, okay? World War One vets didn't get that. They wanted some money when they came back, and they were rejected, hence the bonus march, okay? So we did not embrace the World War One vets. World War II vets, we did, okay? Korea, not so much, all right, because we tied, essentially.
Right.
Vietnam, we rejected them outright. Yeah. And then you had a small sample from the Gulf War, but then you had this era of veterans. So I looked at the country. I said, okay, fine. Civil War, we embrace them when they come back. And what happens, the growth of this country took off in the 1890s to 1910. I mean, it grew like crazy, okay? GDP, companies created, inventions, everything grew like crazy. And then World War One happens, and then vets come back, and then we don't embrace them. And what happens? You get the Civil War. I mean, you got the Great Depression, okay? So it goes to the Great Depression, and then we have World War II vets coming back. And then they come back, and they go to campus and everything else. And what happens? We grow like crazy in the 50s and 60s. Huge amounts of growth, all right? And then that lasts until about mid-70s, early 80s, and then you begin to taper off. Vietnam vets, we did not embrace. And then we end up where we're at right now, with people fighting and yelling and screaming and being in debt and everything else. So I said, okay, what is it then that a veteran brings to the civilian world, to the U.S., that civilians don't? And I have data to back this up. The three things that they are taught, that you never taught a civilian, or civilians never taught this. The three things are, one is the ability to work together for the common goal, whether you like the person or not. You're not taught that in education. you're taught that it's my, you know, this is my grade, this is my notes, this is my stuff, you know, I'm not sharing them with anybody else, okay?
Yeah, group projects are the worst because it's one person doing the work and three others watching them.
Exactly. So that's not taught. The second one is the military teaches the person how to be self-reliant, okay? Mm. Make decisions that allow you to be self-reliant instead of making bad decisions and having to wait for the government bailout, okay? So the military teaches you how to make good decisions and make it be self-reliant. And then the last one is how to put themselves second and the mission first. If you don't teach a generation of people that, they say, the hell with everybody else, I'm doing what's mine, okay? So when you have that, those three things embraced by the veterans, and if that gets transcended in the civilian world, then you have a country moving forward. Because they're working together for the common goal, they're making good choices instead of waiting for the bailout, and they're putting themselves second and the country first. But if you don't teach generation, if you don't embrace an era of veterans, then they don't share that with civilians, and the country goes back to where, you know, I don't care about you, I'm doing it myself, to hell with self-reliance, I'll have the government bail me out, and to hell with the country, you know, I'm doing what's mine.
By having a veteran in the financial services industry, maybe they're not making the decision that makes them a quick buck, but tanks the company. Or
in
law enforcement, maybe they have learned restraint, or they've learned these other things that are making them more successful, but also influencing the people around them.
Exactly. And the more vets you have then, so, you know, influencing civilians, the better off the country is, especially in law enforcement. Because think about it. You've got these guys who are trained to be they're in another country, all right? They're surrounded by people who don't like them, and they have to resolve conflicts. And that's what they do. So you put that same person in the U.S., that's what they're good at. They know how to resolve conflicts. And they're good at what they do on campus is the same thing. Now, here's the one critical factor that supported those three things, okay? And I trade the data with this. I did a study on income inequality in this country from 1910 to 2010, okay? Because we talk about the 1% people, you know, have all the money.
Right, yeah.
So in 1910... you had, let's just say, based on the numbers, the top 1.5% of earners had 15% of the money, okay? So the other 85% of the money in this country was distributed over 98.5% of the people, all right? In 1930, you had the top 1.5% had 45% of the money, okay? So now almost half the money is controlled by a small group of people. Then the Depression hits and everything tanks, okay? And it stays then that the top 1.5% only owned 5% of the money, maximum 10% of the money over the next 50 years, okay? So therefore, more money was shared by the majority of the people in this country, okay? So you go from 50% of the money being controlled by 1% to 5% of the money controlled by 1%. Okay? The wealth is
big difference.
Big difference. Then it begins to creep up. In 1985, it gets up to 25%, and now again it's at 50%. Okay? So, and I'll show you the graph with this. So what happened? All right? Pre-1910, Civil War vets were running everything. Okay? They were doing the businesses, they had everything because they were embraced, okay? Well, they retire in 1915. World War I vets were not embraced. Civilians took over. They then said, to hell with everybody else, I'm taking my own, all right? Then that's when it peaked at 50%. Then the Depression hits, okay? Then World War II occurs in 1950, 1948. They get out, they start having to start running the businesses again. They start being the ones in control. And they start making good decisions, and that keeps it at 5%. We didn't embrace Vietnam vets, okay? So Vietnam vets then, the World War II vets retire in 1982. In 1985, you see the spike. Now, Vietnam vets weren't embraced. They weren't running anything. Civilians took over again and said, to hell with everybody. I'm doing what's mine, taking my money. And they are the ones then that, the reason why we're at right now is because the civilians are running it. And here's the thing. A veteran CEO will not take $1 million a bonus if everybody else doesn't get the $1 million bonus. That's just how they are.
It's that team thinking.
Right. But a civilian says, fuck that, I want a $1 million bonus. Okay?
Yeah, more for me.
So, right, exactly. So if we have, so I realize now that's the reason why the country flounders when we don't support or embrace an era of veterans. So now it's not just about, hey, helping some universities succeed and blah, 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 and helping these. No, it's about the country. This generation of veterans has to succeed for the country to succeed, and I have the data to prove it.
And we'll know that we're not doing well by the suicide rate, and we'll know we're not doing well by the way the economy goes and,
exactly.
and how really the nation turns.
Exactly. That's why I'm doing it. So that my motivation changed. Once I began to look at the bigger picture, started out by solving a problem. And then it just went, I went through all the different reiterations and so on and so forth. And then I realized, no. This is a bigger picture. This is the country now that we have to deal with. Yeah. This is the country that needs these guys to succeed. And it needs to have these. And also, here's a big thing. Universities became extremely liberal right around late 70s, early 80s. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't liberal in the 60s. The people were, or students were, but the universities weren't. So what happened? Here's what happened. And they were liberal in the 40s and the 30s and the 20s. Okay? So what happened was when these World War II vets came back and they owned the classroom, they would talk about stuff and they would say, well, the war was really started because U.S. got involved and U.S. did this. And these vets are like, no. This is what happened. I was over there. Okay? This is what occurred. This is what we saw. They began to question those professors. Okay? Now, the professors are feeling threatened because they're no longer on this ivory pedestal anymore. Now they're being challenged by guys who have lived it instead of read it in a book, okay? So what happened was that wave of veterans in from 48 to 54 forced those professors who were pretty liberal to leave. That's what happened. So now they left, okay? So now you're filled with just conservative professors for all these years. So what happened was then, now, they were the conservative professors stayed in, and they stayed there for all those years up until 1979, and they retired. Well, the Vietnam vets didn't come back to school as well, much as often as the Vietnam vets, as the World War II vets did. So those professors never got challenged. And those professors can say what they want to say because 18-year-olds are too afraid to say anything. These veterans, if they came back to campuses now, then these veterans will challenge those professors. And if they're surrounded by themselves and surrounded by their group, then they'll feel more strongly to do so. But they then will challenge professors and have those guys be challenged, and then they won't be sitting there all the time, spotting off their stuff that's not substantiated. So they can, essentially what they can do is they can change an entire generation by impacting the professors on college campuses, by having them either change their ways or leave. Because it happened before.
Forcing them to sharpen their minds with real experience, with real
exactly.
I guess
and
data.
We got a guy. We got a vet sitting there saying, I can take this guy on. I'm just being shot at. If he ain't shooting at me, I'm fine. Whereas an 18-year-old guy, I don't know what to say. I'm really nervous with my grades. The vet's like, what the hell with this? You know what I'm used to. They'll challenge him because they're used to doing that. That's why I said that's how a generation of veterans can change the way the country goes for many, 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 many years. So,
I think that is excellent food for thought, and it's not a perspective I've ever heard before. So I'm excited to be able to talk about it and to share it. I mean, that's related to another question that I had, through Jake, which was he said I'm concerned I burned my bridges having dropped out, and is that true? Is there no second chance for the GI Bill?
No, because here's the thing, he can get Chapter 31 money based upon the fact that he's disabled, okay? So you got Chapter 31, which is, there's no limit on the years you do it, okay? And that's a much better way to go in many cases than just using the GI Bill. So if he's a disabled vet, he's got Chapter 31. That's right there.
And obviously, getting into the program like you described, so that he has the support and he gets through it with help this time.
Exactly. All he has to show is that, listen, I went through this before, and the VA knows this. The VA knows that the guys have struggled in the beginning, And the universities are all about second chances anyway. Yeah. That's what universities are for, as I said. Universities are used to having people who struggle and then come back and succeed. So, no, don't have him. But in the military, he's thinking, oh, my God, I'm out. I've been put in the brig. Yeah. I'm done. I ain't coming back. That's not how the university is. And I have plenty of examples in my own classes. I had guys who took 2 weeks off you know, because they're freaked out. And I said, that's why I created the program, for you to come back. And he did. He came back, graduated in 3 years, and he's successful now. I love him to death.
Yeah, if you fail a mission, that may be your last chance, but you get second chances at school. I think that's great.
And the problem he had was he came up on the anniversary. I didn't know this. He came up on the anniversary. He was in Ramadi. Remember the guys got hung by the bridge? The guys that got burned on that mission?
Yep.
Yeah, that was his group. That was his company. And he couldn't go out there and get them because he was going to get annihilated. So we got to watch all that stuff, and it was just terrible. And then the anniversary came up of that. I didn't know it, you know. So he was gone for 2 weeks. He went AWOL, so I was like, I got to find him. So he called me up and said, shoot, man, can I come back? I said, absolutely. That's why we had the program. That's exactly why we created the program for this to occur.
The third question that Jake posed was the one that concerned me the most, particularly related to doing a PhD. And he talked about how he got help with some of his mental health issues from the VA, but he was concerned he'd have a recurrence. And having been through a PhD program, to me, it is academically rigorous, fine, but emotionally, it is very difficult. And I had every advantage and a supportive network around me. Have you seen vets go through PhD programs, and what works for that?
I've had many vets get dissertations on what I just talked about. You know, the whole thing about education and everything else, they've done it on based on what I talked about. So, yeah, but it's challenging. But if they have a good support network around them, plus the professor, then they'll do it. And they do something they're passionate about. You know, if that mission fulfills what they want, like he was talking about, you know, it's all about, essentially it's about germ warfare, okay? So if he can have somebody who embraces that, then he'll be passionate about it, and he'll get it done in no time. I mean, they know how to do schedules. They know how to do time management. They'll do it in no time. It's just a matter of just finding the right environment around you. That's all. And finding the right campus that will embrace it. So I said a coastal school will do that. You're already military-friendly on the coastal campuses anyways, more so than somebody on the inside.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got Florida, Georgia. I mean, they all got the bases there. So you've all got these schools that know vets, so it's a breeze for them. They understand it versus somebody like Ohio or Indiana, or, you know, people that have any bases in the state, the school's not used to the military versus the coastal states.
Yeah, they just don't.
I've always seen the environment, the enrollment on the coastal, the percent vets on the coastal campuses are huge compared to the ones inside the inner campuses, you know, the interstates. So.
And so you would direct students, veteran students, to those places where they are more likely to find a cohort to fill that class.
And tell him, you know, if he contacts me, then I'll start calling some campuses around that I know are good. You know, I've got my contacts in over 400 of them, and I'll just say, hey, I got a guy who wants to do a research project. Give me somebody there who's in line with this.
That's great. Where can people go to learn more if they want to learn about these programs and more about the research?
If I only had a website, I don't have one. Have them just contact me. You got my email. I got tons and tons and tons of data. And just have them contact me, and I'll put them in the right direction.
We'll put your contact info on the web so they can get a hold of you. And thank you so much for taking the time. Is there anything else, any other advice or key nuggets of wisdom you'd like to give out to PhD students or postdocs?
Tell them that because they're veterans, they can get the STTR funding is a really great way to go to get their funding or get the research funded through the DOD, because they are already military and they understand that. And then the DOD wants to fund veterans in these projects. So this is a great way for them to get their business started, get their research funded, and get their degree at the same time. And the universities then say, hey, you come with money? Hell yeah, I'll work with you. You've already got your research funded.
That's clever. An alternate funding source is fantastic. Then the competition is different.
Exactly.
And you're obviously a shoo-in because you've got that experience.
And I'm going to email you a list of, there's going to be four agencies and what they're putting out this year for solicitations, okay? So you'll see all the different research topics out there. And then there's hundreds of them. And they give out $2 billion a year. In research. I got one back in 2004. So they give out $2 billion a year in research projects. They're mandatory to do that. They have to do that. The SBA says we've got to set aside 3% of our funding for these research projects for the military. That's $2 billion.
Wow.
So I'll send you the ones I've got for 2015 that expires in October 28th or whatever. That just gives the students a flavor as to these topics that are out there. And if they can solve those problems, they're funded. And they get funded, they get phase one, phase two, phase three. Phase one is 100,000, phase two is 500,000, phase three is like 2 or 3 million.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I will put all these resources up on the website, and then you can direct people to it when they ask.
Perfect.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Bye-bye.
All right, cool. See you.